Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated August 12th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. On the front page, top of the fold, State Orders Grant to Cease and Desist by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. The North Carolina Department of the Secretary of State and the North Carolina Real Estate Commission have launched investigations into the financial dealings of Raleigh real estate investor Carolyn Grant and her company Omega Property Group. The Secretary of the State's office on August 4th issued a temporary cease and desist order against Grant and Omega Property Group for alleged violations of the North Carolina Securities Act. According to the order, Grant has never been registered as a dealer or seller of securities as required by state law, nor have the securities she sold to individual investors and their families been registered with the Secretary of State's Securities Division as required by the North Carolina Securities Act. The cease and desist order restricts Grant from making any offers or sales of stock or other equity interest or securities until the issue is resolved. Grant, contacted at her home, says she plans to appeal the cease and desist order, but she referred other questions to her lawyer, Kieran Shanahan of Raleigh. Shanahan says that Grant will appeal the cease and desist order, even though she is not currently looking for investors for any real estate projects. The bottom line is when people lose money, they look hard for people to blame, she says. Regarding the allegations that she was soliciting money without first registering as a securities dealer with the state, Shanahan says that the way he and Grant's other lawyers have read the law, her actions did not meet the investment threshold that required her to register with the Secretary of State. Quote, we believe she did not need to be licensed for what she was doing, end quote, he says. More than $3.2 million in Wake County civil court judgments have been handed down against Grant and her company in relation to more than a dozen loans received from individual investors dating back to 2006. Several other civil lawsuits are pending against Grant, former chair of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce and unsuccessful candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives. Secretary of State spokesman Liz Proctor confirms that an investigation into Grant and Omega Property Group is ongoing. The order notes that Grant and her company offered and sold promissory notes to more than 25 people between July 18, 2008 and July 13, 2009 to help fund real estate development projects that Grant was involved in that stretched across North Carolina from the mountains to the coast. In at least one insurance instance, the court documents state that Grant received $300,000 in 2006 from a Carolina Beach investor that was supposed to go toward a land development project in Watauga County. However, another partner in the project says the money was never used for the Watauga land, and the investor has not received any repayment of principal or interest, according to the cease and desist order. Evidence submitted to the North Carolina Real Estate Commission by a group of note holders shows that more than 75 promissory notes with a total loan value of nearly $7.6 million were issued to more than 50 individuals and married couples between August 2006 and April 2010, each with a personal guarantee signed by Grant. Documents received from the Real Estate Commission's legal counsel show the Commission is investigating multiple complaints filed against Grant and her partners regarding management of deposit of funds and personal loans made for a recently foreclosed condominium development in downtown Wilmington called The View on Water Street and a canceled housing development on Spring Forest Road in Raleigh. Tom Miller, legal counsel for the Commission, says the agency has two open case files related to Grant's real estate projects, and an investigation into the validity of the complaints is ongoing. In cases in which the commission decides disciplinary action is warranted, a real estate broker's license could be in jeopardy. Under state securities laws, violators could be charged with a Class C or a Class 1 felony, depending on the severity of the violation. A person convicted of a Class 1 felony could be sentenced to 3 to 8 months in prison. If the securities violation involves a transaction of more than $100,000, a person could be charged with a Class C felony with a potential sentence of 44 to 92 months in prison for a first-time offender. Most of the people who invested with Grant live in North Carolina and are people she met through her activities in the Triangle and Wilmington communities, including her year as chair of the Raleigh Chamber. Others are people she met through her political fundraising activities across the Southeast and her travels abroad. Grant was one of the sponsors of a fundraising event for Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney at the home of PPD founder Fred Eshelman in May. One of the largest investors in Grant's real estate projects is noted racehorse trainer Dermot Weld of Ireland. North Carolina Secretary of State Elaine Marshall says she cannot comment specifically about the investigation into Grant and Omega Property Group, but she did advise any investor considering a purchase of securities from any individual or group to first make contact with the Secretary of State's office to make sure they are properly registered. Quote, "A phone call to us can literally save your life savings," Marshall says. "The most important thing for every potential investor to remember is that it is your money. You should never hesitate to ask questions, starting with whether the person you are dealing with is properly registered with the state to sell securities," end quote. Since 2009, the Secretary of State's office has issued 8 cease and desist orders regarding violations of the North Carolina Securities Act. 2 such orders are pending. Investors can contact the North Carolina Department of the Secretary of State's investor hotline at 1-800-688-4507. Next up, Wake Med Beds Grab High Profit by Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. When Wake Med Health and Hospital expands its rehabilitation unit by 14 beds, it will build on a unit with a profit margin percentage triple that of the overall system. In fiscal year 2010, Wake Med Rehabilitation Hospital earned a net income of $5.3 million on $34 million in revenue for a 15.7% profit margin. By comparison, the Wake Med Hospital system posted a 4.7% profit margin on $916 million in revenue for fiscal year 2010. The state regulates health care facilities in an effort to hold down costs and awarded 14 additional rehabilitation beds to Wake Med on July 28, which will increase the system's rehab bed total to 98. Wake Med plans to invest $2.4 million for a 7,300-square-foot renovation, says Robbie Roberts, the hospital's planning and regulatory consultant. Due to Medicare reimbursement rules, rehabilitation hospitals must admit at least 60% of its patients for a very specific condition. Otherwise, Medicare cuts funding. That has driven some smaller hospitals into the red or even forced them to shut down. Since 2005, 56 rehab facilities, or 4.5% of the total, were shuttered, according to Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, or MedPAC, an independent agency set up to advise Congress on Medicare issues. Since 2004, Medicare has not increased its spending on inpatient rehabilitation facilities. By comparison, all post-acute care spending by Medicare increased 53%. From $37.5 billion in 2003 to $57.2 billion in 2010, according to MedPAC data. Medicare spending on post-acute care has more than doubled since 2001. Larger rehabilitation hospitals like Wake Med have been able to survive due largely to economies of scale, says Stan Taylor, Wake Med Vice President of Corporate Planning. Rehabilitation hospitals need highly specialized staff, says Medical Director Dr. Patrick O'Brien, and a large hospital allows for one or two people to handle the workload for a larger patient population. Of the 84-bed rehab hospitals with 51 job classifications, 33 are staffed by 2 full-time equivalent positions or less. Quote, "These facilities have become highly specialized," O'Brien says. "One of the things we are very proud of is the rehabilitation team that has been assembled," end quote. As total rehabilitation stays are decreasing nationwide, WakeMed has been at 90% capacity since 2000. The WakeMed expansion will add 34.89 new full-time equivalent employees with 13.5 full-time equivalent staff nurses and 4.1 full-time equivalent nurses' aides. The remaining 17.29 full-time equivalent positions will be distributed across 15 different job classifications. Overall, total salaries will increase by 16% from $14.3 million in the last year before the expansion to $16.6 million in the first full operating year with 98 beds. The nursing staff will comprise more than half of the workers at the rehab hospital, which reflects the 24/7 care required, says O'Brien. With the area's population of those age 65 or older projected to increase by 21.3% by 2015, the extra rehab beds made sense to Don Dalton, the North Carolina Hospital Association Vice President of Public Affairs. Quote, "We are an aging state and our population is still growing," he says, "so I think those are the factors for the new beds," end quote. Indeed, Medicare makes up 59% of WakeMed Rehabilitation Hospital's total revenue, while commercial insurance covers only 25% of the total. By comparison, Medicare comprised 36% of revenue for the WakeMed system in 2010, while commercial insurance made up 41.1% of total revenue. Three other hospital systems, Duke Raleigh Hospital, UNC Hospitals, and Johnston Memorial Hospital, also filed applications for the bed in February. They have until the end of August to appeal the state's decision. WakeMed plans to award a construction contract for space to house the additional beds by March 15, 2012, and open the beds to patients by October 1, 2012. That timeline could be altered depending on what happens with the appeals process. Our lead story for this week, RDU singled out by air researchers for efficiency. Local airport finishes second only to Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson. By Chris Bagley from Morrisville. Chalk up yet another first for the area, this time courtesy of the Raleigh-Durham International Airport. A 2011 worldwide study on airports concluded RDU International to be the most efficient airport among small and mid-size airports in the country. The Vancouver, BC-based Air Transport Research Society concluded that being financially efficient generally results in lower fees charged to airlines and on-site shops and restaurants. That, in turn, can translate into lower airfares, says Michael Durchin, an airline analyst for CRT Capital Group, LLC. RDU is one of half a dozen airports where fees charged to airlines amount to less than $5 for each passenger in the most recent fiscal year that ATRS examined airport financials. By comparison, Minetta San Jose charges about $11, Chicago O'Hare charges about $12, and JFK International in New York charges about $24, according to the ATRS study. Study co-author and ATRS research manager Sam Chu says the most efficient airports generally benefit from extensive use of private sector contractors. Quote, "Certain tasks or functions can be economized by outsourcing," says Chu. RDU was judged against airports that process fewer than 15 million outbound passengers. The study also ranked RDU second in the nation among all airports. Atlanta Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport topped the list among all airports. Chu adds the most efficient airports tend to draw large shares of their overall revenue from non-flight line items, such as parking fees and lease revenues that concessionaires pay because those business lines typically carry wider profit margins for the airports. The pricing model is similar to that of convenience stores, which compete ferociously for gasoline customers and earn most of their profits on snacks and drinks, Chu notes. RDU in fiscal 2010 derived 30.5% of its $90.9 million in revenue from fees paid by airlines, according to a report on the airport's operations by Moody's Investor Services. Other key revenue generators for the airport were parking fees, 38.2% of total revenue, rental car fees, 12.8%, and concessionaire fees, 6.1%, according to Moody's. RDU Airport Authority Chairman Terry Yergin says the board and longtime airport director John Bradley have focused on keeping the airport's operation lean and nimble. Yergin also credits the airport's governing structure. Durham, Raleigh, Durham County, and Wake County are all represented on the board's airport's board prevent the airport from being run as an extension of any one local government, he says. It has to be run completely like a business, Yergin says. We're entirely dependent on the success of the airlines and the customers. Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson led North American airports in efficiency, according to the ATRS study, which measured outputs such as takeoffs and restaurant meals relative to the amount of labor and other inputs that airports can control from one month to the next, and not on fixed inputs such as physical and capital stock. Southeastern airports were heavily represented among the top performers. Nashville ranked 4th, Charlotte 6th, Tampa 7th, Orlando 9th, and Richmond 10th. While it's difficult to make direct comparison with other continents, North American airports tend to operate more efficiently than their counterparts overseas. So Atlanta and Raleigh-Durham may well be the two most efficient in the world, she says. Moody's, which evaluates and rates public debt, rates RDU's bond AA3, the fourth highest of 13 possible ratings. A handful of airports' borrowings are rated AA2, the third highest level, and none are rated AAA or AA1. Raleigh-Durham is efficient compared even to other airports with a strong AA2 and AA3 ratings, according to Moody's figures. While airlines' cost per enplaned passengers at RDU rose to $5.92 in the last year, that's 30% below the $8.45 figure Moody cites for the other AA2 and AA3 rated airports. The airport has a track record of very solid financial management, Moody's analyst Martina Matanzas says. Continuing on the front page, below the fold, study, North Carolina, most reliant state in nation on federal funding, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. North Carolina ranks number one in its reliance on federal funding, says a new study, putting it in a high-risk position as spending cut talks intensify in the nation's capital. During fiscal 2010, the baseline year for the study by RBC Capital Markets, federal aid in various forms are made up of 43.4% of North Carolina spending. Missouri was second at 41.3%. Arizona third at 41%, and Illinois fourth with 40%. North Carolina's 43.4% ratio is well above the average of 30% received by states in 2010. Some other 18 states had federal aid contributions of 30% or higher, according to the study. RBC Capital Markets analyst Chris Morrow undertook the study on the assumption that if deficit reduction and corresponding spending cuts come to pass, states hardest hit by the action would end up having to borrow more money by issuing bonds to make up the gap. North Carolina state debt stood at $7 billion as of June 30th. Local government debt in North Carolina stood at $28.7 billion. Considering the various budget-cutting scenarios being played out in Washington, D.C., Morrow doesn't believe that federal cuts to state appropriations will arrive in one fell swoop. Nevertheless, he adds, we believe that any federal aid cuts will represent a modest drag on state budgets, potentially negating some of the tax revenue growth that many states are currently realizing. End quote. Local governments, he adds, will bear most of the brunt. General Assembly financial researcher Rodney Bizzell says he couldn't comment on the report without reading it first. Even so, Bizzell points out, the fiscal 2010 numbers used by RBC came two budget seasons ago, and the state's reliance on federal dollars has probably decreased since then. To arrive at a federal aid figure for each state, RBC combined U.S. mandatory spending on such items as Medicaid, and discretionary appropriations by Congress for a variety of purposes, including veterans benefits, transportation, and other uses. In North Carolina in 2010, the federal aid total was nearly $13.8 billion, which was 43.4% of total state spending of $31.8 billion. That spending total included both state and general fund appropriations and the federal contribution. In Missouri, the next most reliant state on federal dollars, the U.S. contribution was $10.2 billion in 2010, some 41.3% of total state spending of $24.8 billion. As to analyst Morrow's conclusion that it would be local governments ultimately bearing the heaviest load if deficit reduction comes to pass, Todd McGee of the North Carolina Association of County Commissioners says local officials are only just beginning to explore the topic. Quote, "It came up in a recent call with managers," he says, "but it's still too early to say what it means," end quote. Leaving the front page and going inside, the next article is titled, "Raleigh Investors Going Long with $48 Million," by Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh, Bell Tower Advisors, a two-year-old money manager that focuses on commodity stocks, has amassed around $48 million for a new fund that will invest long only in both domestic and international securities. In a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the firm says seven investors have bought into its new Global Natural Resources Fund, which launched in July. The investors were not identified. For its previous fund, Belltower used both hold and short selling techniques, essentially classifying the shop as a hedge fund operation. "Our new fund is long only and not a hedge fund," says Belltower founder and managing member Mark Corigliano. "It will, however, have the same commitment to commodity stocks. Quote, we think it's going to be a good long-term play," he adds. As of March 31st, according to SEC filings, Belltower had $171 million under management in 18 stocks. Among the 18 companies were energy, coal, and drilling equipment firms. The largest stake, some 1.8 million shares, was in Canada-based precious metals miner North American Palladium Limited, according to Belltower's SEC filings. Corigliano and two partners, all three have MBAs from UNC Chapel Hill and wide money managing experience, launched Belltower back in 2009, having purchased a then $52 million hedge fund they once managed for Madrid, Spain-based Proxima Alpha. On to those funds was added an infusion from a foundation, which the partners have declined to identify. Corigliano also declined to discuss Belltower's returns. North Carolina's hedge fund industry is split between the Triangle and Charlotte. Other Raleigh-based hedge operations on scale include Shaw Capital and Hatteras Funds. Following the financial meltdown of 2008, as a general rule of thumb, most new investor cash tended to flow into the more established hedge fund shops, says Gilbert Davis of the Atlanta-based Southeastern Hedge Fund Association. Quote, it has been only recently that we've begun seeing more money flowing towards the emerging managers, Davis says. That's been what we were seeing until this week. But after what's been happening in the markets, who knows? If people thought rationally, allocation into hedge funds would continue. End quote. Industry-wide hedge funds, which are unregulated pools of private capital, finished up 1.4% year-to-date through July, with managers positioning themselves to preserve capital as stocks began to sell off, says Charles Gradante, co-founder of the New York-based Hennessy Group. Long-short equity, as a broadly defined class, did better than the average, finishing up 2.23%, according to Hennessy. Next up, Building Ready as IPO Awaits, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Morrisville, the husband and wife owners of a Morrisville computer equipment company have taken the first legal steps toward forming a publicly traded company called Blue Data Corporation that would serve as a holding company for a pending business merger. They also have purchased an office building in Morrisville they were previously leasing to serve as the new company's headquarters. Kenneth and Deborah Bloom of Norwalk, Connecticut, are not discussing details about the pending merger deal, noting that they are still in a quiet period under U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission's guidelines. But they say the deal could result in the creation of new jobs in the Triangle. The Blooms in 2006 acquired all the assets of Visera International, a Morisco company that designs and manufactures peripheral equipment for data centers that use IBM mainframe computers, and moved the company and its 20 employees from a building on Mount Hermon Road to 2700 Gateway Center Boulevard building in Morrisville. Visera became a subsidiary of the Blooms Avenir Technologies Company, but kept its identity and its operations in the Triangle. Deborah Bloom says she and her husband have wanted to purchase the building since taking occupancy in early 2007 and were able to work out a deal in late July with her landlord, the Dilwig Companies of Durham. They bought the nearly 50,000 square foot facility for $6 million. Bruce Knott, chief operating officer of the Dilwig Corporation, says the Blooms were able to apply for a low interest owner occupant financing loan through the Small Business Administration because the Blooms companies occupy about 60% of the building space. Bloom says they will continue leasing the remaining space in the building to other corporate tenants, which include Home Paramount Pest Control and Versagenics. Only 1,200 square feet of space was vacant at the close of the deal, Knott says. Quote, it was a deal sweetener for them because it gives them an upgrade path for future, and in the meantime, they have rent coming in to help pay for the mortgage, Knott says. Regarding Blue Data Corporation, the company was incorporated in December 2010, but is not yet trading shares on a public exchange. Documents filed with the SEC show that Blue Data was organized to serve as a vehicle for a business combination with an operating or development stage company that wanted to go public. Kenneth Bloom is president and CEO of Deborah Bloom, and Deborah Bloom as chief financial officer have so far advanced the company $64,811 in loans. Continuing on, perform for pay. And Whitehurst tie pay to growth of company's value. By Monica Chin from Raleigh. One of the 25 highest paid CEOs of public companies based in the Triangle in 2010, 17 led companies whose stocks rose in price in 2010. It's a confluence that occurring during a time when an increasing number of public company boards are more closely tying executive pay to the performance of the business's share. Jim Whitehurst, CEO of Red Hat Incorporated, was the highest paid CEO in the Triangle in 2010. He had a base salary of $700,000, which was unchanged from 2009, and a total compensation of $7.3 million, compared to $6.1 million in 2009, an increase of 20.3%. In the same time period, the company's stock increased by 46.7%. Whitehurst says that an executive's compensation should be based on the performance of the company's stock. If you're not performing, you should not be getting paid, he says. Other companies that have been generous with their CEOs are Progress Energy, whose board gave CEO Bill Johnson a base salary of $990,000, just under the tax-deductible ceiling of $1 million, and stocks that add up to total compensation of $6.2 million. Dex One Corporation, which experienced a 77.8% decline in stock price in 2010, provided CEO Alfred Mockett, new to the company in 2010, with $300,000 in base salary and $5.2 million in total compensation. That was a salary cut compared to his predecessor, David Swanson, who had $957,624 in base salary and $7.9 million in total compensation in 2009. Edward Van Wessep, finance professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Keenan Flagler Business School, notes the mood of some shareholders who became angered when CEOs of companies in which they are invested do not deliver value by increasing share prices, yet are paid exorbitant amounts. Only extreme cases cause flare-ups, he says, adding, quote, it seems unlikely to me that any but the most extreme abuses will be reined in, end quote. He says a big difference now is that people believe now in deferred stock compensation rather than options. Stocks over a longer term do engender a much longer term outlook for the CEO. Instead of stock options, which are very valuable when the underlying stock is volatile and rewards good luck. John Graham, professor of corporate finance in the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University, says that the spotlight on CEOs and shareholder objections have combined to alter the way some companies reward their C-level executives. Quote, I think a notable number of companies have now had their shareholders object. It's still less than 10% of companies, but it's a lot bigger number than it used to be. Companies see this trend and say, we don't want to be a company that has the shareholder revolt, Graham says, end quote. Whitehurst acknowledges that the compensation gap between the CEO and the frontline employees across most industries is widening, but he is quick to assert that any kind of regulation is not the answer. I don't know the answer, but I think this is concerning, Whitehurst says, referring to the compensation levels and the gradual disappearance of the middle class from the U.S. economy. And now, NC Pension Fund gains solid but significantly trails others, by Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. While respectable, the latest investment returns chalked up by the North Carolina pension system doesn't rise to the numbers being posted by some other states. North Carolina's Retirement Committee, North Carolina's Retirement Kitty, completed fiscal 2011, which ended June 30th, up 18.4%. That was 0.48% below the system's own 12-month benchmark target of 18.96%. And well behind the low to mid 20% returns reported by a number of other states. As of June 30th, before the recent stock market swings, North Carolina had pension assets of $74.9 billion. Meanwhile, Florida, with $128 billion in public pension assets, reported fiscal year returns of 22%. Ohio State Teachers, with $66 billion, chalked up 22.6%. The state of Wisconsin, with $77 billion in total assets, finished its fiscal year up 22.9%, while Massachusetts, with $50 billion, racked up 22.3%. And California Public Employees Retirement Systems, CalPERS, the nation's largest system with $237 billion in assets, saw a gain of 20.7%. The Wisconsin performance was its best in 25 years, says spokeswoman Vicki Hearing. Meanwhile, Ohio Teachers hadn't posted a comparable number since 1983. As for comment, Julia Vail, spokeswoman for the North Carolina Treasurer Janet Cowell, says the investment division's primary goal remains meeting its required rate of return of 7.25%, the level needed to ensure that the system can meet its benefit payout obligations. Beyond that, Vail points out to on the subject of bonds, stating, quote, our high allocation to investment-grade fixed income relative to other states tends not to produce returns as high as other states during increasing equity markets, but provides the pension fund with solid returns in all market environments, end quote. Keith Brainerd, research director of the National Association of Retirement Administrators, pegged the higher performances being experienced by many of the states in part to a wider diversification of assets, including more cash committed on a percentage basis to, quote, real estate, private equity, hedge funds, end quote, and the like. North Carolina, too, has expanded the types of investments it uses, moving from the four basic classes to six within the addition of new strategies, credit, 3.3% of assets, and inflation, 3.2%. Even so, the key decision always facing pension managers is how much the state wants to put in higher return stocks versus lower yielding bonds. Historically conservative, North Carolina has generally gone with a healthy dose of bonds and has been rewarded for it. Bonds are the only asset class in which North Carolina pension managers have bettered their own internal return benchmarks over 1, 3, 5, and 10 years. The state's love affair with fixed income continues. As of June 30th, in fact, the system continued to have nearly 38% of its assets in bonds with 45.2% in stocks. Meanwhile, pension managers in other states have been moving away from fixed income into riskier assets. As of September 30, 2010, according to Pension and Investments Magazine, the nation's top 200 pension systems, on average, were committing 27% of their cash to bond investments and 53.49% in stocks. According to Wisconsin's hearing, that state's commitments to bonds is 25.6% and 54.8% to stocks. North Carolina pension managers haven't flashed any signals that they plan to change the state's long-held policy on fixed income investments anytime soon. Now the 11th largest public pension fund in the country, the North Carolina pension system provides retirement benefits and savings for more than 850,000 North Carolinians, including teachers, state employees, firefighters, police officers, and other public workers. Next up, in Durham, finding ways to house young firms cheap, by Monica Chen. From Durham. With entrepreneurial activities bustling in downtown Durham, developers in the city center, where foot traffic is still scant in some areas, are moving forward with innovative financing and mixed-use plans to satisfy growing demand for short-term, low-rent spaces. Aaron Averill, owner of Cary-based software firm Zone 5 Software, was under contract to buy 106 Paris Street, a three-story building originally constructed in 1906. He plans to invest more than $1 million to turn it into a mixed-use residential and commercial project. Drawn to downtown Durham by its urban setting, Averill, who is originally from Portland, Oregon, founded development firm Velocity Redevelopment to do a gut rehab on the building. Averill and his wife, Stacy Jasper, will take the top floor as their own condominium. The second floor and first floor could be used for office space or retail. The 2,000-square-foot floor plates could be used in a variety of ways, by a single-growth stage tech company, as a co-working space, or subdivided for startups. Averill, who will be straddling the tech and the development worlds in the project, sees opportunities in providing flexible spaces and short-term leases to growing tech firms in downtown Durham. Quote, "There are a lot of things in the tech startup space you could apply to commercial leasing," he says. "People talk about commercial leases that are 5 years long, and that's just inconceivable in my mind. I'm planning on partnering with my tenants, possibly collaborating on advertising and web design. We'll mix it up," end quote. Tech firms largely need flexibility and affordability in office space. According to a survey conducted at the end of the Bull City Startup Stampede Free Space Program, 13 of the 16 startups cited rent below $500 a month as a critical issue in their search for office space. 10 of the startups also said short-term flexible leases were critical. So far, many startups in the city center have congregated in the Snow Building, an Art Deco building at 335 West Main Street that's currently 95% occupied. As companies grow and add employees, they outgrow 500 square feet and begin searching for 1,200 to 2,000 square feet and more. Adam Klein, Director of Strategic Initiatives with the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce, says there are opportunities of various properties in downtown to meet such need, but whether those spaces can be move-in ready for startups is the issue. Quote, "It's a combination of the difficulty of startups needing a flexible and dynamic space and having a property owner who's willing to meet them somewhere in the middle and have the cash to do the upfront work," he says. The financing environment is still difficult for developers, particularly those of rundown historic buildings. Major banks that Averill turned to asked for 75% pre-lease, a requirement that Averill says is impossible to meet for a building that has sat vacant for 12 years and needs a gut renovation. Velocity is lining up financing and expects to close in September. Construction could be completed by next summer. Averill hopes historic tax credits and Durham City grants will help move some of the cost. Scott Harmon, owner of the Center Studio Architecture, an architecture firm in downtown Durham, is working with Averill to design the space. For his own project at 102 Morris Street at Five Points, Harmon's development firm, RE Vamp Durham, has turned to innovative mixed financing to fund the project. Harmon divided the building into pieces that could be owned separately by small businesses. The top floor will be residential apartments. RE Vamp and Center Studio will receive fees for their services. Self-Help Credit Union and KeySource Commercial Bank are providing the funding via a SBA 504 loan that offers low down payments and favorable terms for owner-occupied commercial real estate. That approach solves the problem of the high pre-leasing requirements. Other developers are moving ahead with renovation efforts in downtown. On Paris Street, Greenfire Development recently finished renovating 108 West Paris Street, home to the North Carolina Institute of Minority Economic Development. John Warasilla, owner of Alliance Architecture, is in talks with three tech firms to convert Rigsby Hall, a 4,000-square-foot venue at 208 Rigsby Avenue, into office space. Warasilla also has been in talks with American Tobacco Campus to expand American Underground into bargain furniture at 309 East Chapel Hill Street. And now it's time for A Better World. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. Comfort Zone Camp serves bereaved kids. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. You can indeed take it with you. That's the philosophy of Paul Holmes, who says his job and personal life have taught him that the loss of a parent or guardian can have a devastating impact on a child, including the loss of the family's way of life. You have to change the house, says Holmes, a Raleigh-based managing partner at New York Life for Central and Eastern North Carolina. The surviving parent has to go to work, full-time or double-time, and you have to change schools if you move to a new house. The grief resulting from the death of a parent can damage a child in other ways as well, with research finding one child in five who loses a parent is likely to develop emotional disorders, says Mary Wolcomer, assistant to the president of Legacy Private Client Services in Raleigh and event director for Comfort Zone Camp of North Carolina. Comfort Zone Camp, which is based in Richmond, Virginia, and says it is the largest bereavement camp in the U.S. for children ages 7 to 17 who experienced the death of a parent, sibling, or primary caregiver, received a $3.2 million grant from the New York Life Foundation in 2008 to expand to five regional sites with a total of 38 camps at the end of 2010. Holmes spearheaded development of North Carolina's first Comfort Zone Camp, launched last year as a one-day free camp at the RBC Center in Raleigh and funded with proceeds from a golf tournament. This year, the camp will be held December 2nd through the 4th at Camp Kanata in Raleigh and expects to attract at least 100 children from throughout North Carolina. And the second annual Comfort Zone Camp for Kids Charity Golf Classic will be held September 19th at Briar Creek Country Club in Raleigh, with New York Life signed on as title sponsor for $10,000. The camp includes age-based therapeutic group sessions and programs that are a mix of fun and traditional camp activities, all designed to build children's strength and confidence, Wolcomer says. Campers are also assigned to big buddies who provide one-on-one mentoring, encouraging kids to take risks and show their vulnerabilities, she says. Comfort Zone Camp is a safe and supportive environment for kids where they can share what they otherwise might not be able to, she says. Bereaved kids, without the benefit of a healthy support system, are at risk. Holmes says he deals with bereavement all the time in his work, with New York Life last year paying out $30 million in death and benefits in Central and Eastern North Carolina. The pain of loss is also personal, he says. Holmes says his college roommate, Ron DeFrancesco, was the last person to leave the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, before it collapsed. I felt this was a way of giving back, of being grateful that he survived, Holmes says, of New York Life's supporting of Comfort Zone Camp, and also acknowledging those that didn't. Todd Cohen is editor and publisher of the Philanthropy Journal. Continuing on, app developers finding revenue by designing for others, by Monica Chin. From Durham, faced with challenges in marketing and revenue generation for recreational mobile applications, some app developers in the Triangle have turned to another avenue of revenue by developing apps for other organizations on a contract basis. Little Green Software, a three-year-old mobile app development company housed in Bull City Forward in downtown Durham, has four employees and will hire six more this year. The company also works with 12 developers on a contract basis. The company has found steady work in serving higher education and healthcare clients, such as Duke University Medical Center, with which it's building an app on teen obesity prevention. Ed Holsworth, founder of Little Green, has a background in gaming and previously worked at Emergent Game Technologies. When he founded Little Green on October 2008, he created casual recreational apps, but quickly discovered it was difficult to sustain revenue. Tally-O, the early app he created, allowed users to build and share adventures. say, through downtown Durham or the Dinosaur and Wildlife Walk at the North Carolina Museum of Life and Science. It was spotlighted by Apple Inc. as an app of the week, but still only garnered just about $5,000 in sales. By comparison, development contracts for clients can run $30,000 and above. It's hard to stand out, Holsworth says, of the app marketplace. Even if you do get the attention, it's a sustained attention to generate real revenue that's hard to come by. Eventually, Holsworth hopes the company will be able to use its accumulated skills to dip back into developing its own casual apps. We think we have a pretty good sense of what it takes to succeed in the app marketplace, Holsworth says. It's just that it's a longer-term and higher-risk venture, whereas services is something that is a little bit more stable. Two Toasters, a three-year-old app company, and American Underground also began as a casual app development company and has also turned to being a service provider, serving retail and media clients, including The Onion. The company currently has 9 employees and plans to hire 4 more this year. Ultimately, says co-founder Ratchet Shakula, who comes from an advertising background, he envisions Two Toasters as a product development company, a problem solver for hire with skills in mobile app development. The company's first app, iQuibble, offered accurate directional pointing towards Mecca. The app ratcheted up $20,000 in sales. Two Toasters charges $40,000 and up for work with clients. Both Little Green and Two Toasters have been bootstrapped and grown organically. For a consulting company like us, I haven't found a good use for venture money or how to produce those returns that outside investors are looking for, Shakula says. In this area, I think the venture capital firms are here still on the sidelines when it comes to mobile. The mobile app development space has matured quickly since Apple introduced the first iPhone in 2007. Workers in gaming and software development can easily translate their skills for the app space, but that means there's the disadvantage of increased competition. John Austin, director of Joystick Labs, a gaming accelerator in American Underground, says an emerging challenge is that more than half of the apps are now for free, and developers are moving towards generating revenue through in-app purchases. There is a very rapid evolution of the business model for games. Even a couple of years ago, most games would sell for 99 cents to $2.99, he says. More than half the games on the App Store now are free to download, with some monetization that goes on after you've downloaded the game. All 6 companies in Joystick's first session in 2010 were mobile game developers. Some are raising money. Some are working to ship a game while working in part-time jobs. Up next, better cell signals coming to RBC Center, Wi-Fi Next, by Jason DeBrun from Raleigh. If you catch a hockey game this fall, your cell phone should display more than 1 or 2 service strength bars typically picked up inside the RBC Center. The Centennial Authority, which manages the arena where the Carolina Hurricanes and North Carolina State University men's basketball teams play, has reached an agreement with AT&T Incorporated to enhance cellular service in the building. AT&T will pay the authority at least $30,000 for the enhanced cell coverage, up from $23,000 for the current service. The service will improve phone reception and perhaps lead to the arena ramping up in in-game services and marketing pushes to fans. But such services won't proliferate until the authority can afford to establish Wi-Fi in the building, a service that would cost anywhere from $96,000 to $138,000 in annual maintenance costs, according to Bill Moore, president of Global Telecommunications Incorporated, who is a consultant to the authority. A Wi-Fi network would allow the Hurricanes, the Wolfpack, and team sponsors to more effectively send out direct promotions or advertisements to anyone on the network. For example, if the RBC Center booked Prince for a show, it could immediately advertise and sell tickets. Certainly, the increased cell coverage would allow some of that, says Steve Shroud, chairman of the Centennial Authority Building Committee. Teams can advertise on the arena scoreboards, and patrons can use their smartphones to go online in response to an ad, Stroud says. In Wi-Fi, teams could send a direct link to anyone online through the RBC Center network. Stroud's committee is going back to the drawing board on the Wi-Fi network idea in hopes of finding a way to make it less costly. The Better Cell service should be ready in the next 4 months, and that makes regular RBC Center attendees happy. Cell service was bad within the building, says Michael Weeks, an NC State alum and strong university supporter. In much of the building, there was no service at all. So much of what happens here happens below ground, says Jeff Merritt, Centennial Authority Executive Director. Per the deal with AT&T, the cellular company will install an enhanced antenna system in the arena at a cost of about $800,000 to $1.2 million. The company will also pay the Centennial Authority at least $30,000 annual, as well as $9,000 annually for every other provider that uses those antennas. Global's Moore says it's a near certainty that at least Verizon Wireless would make a deal with AT&T and considers it likely that other providers as well will. Representatives from both AT&T and Verizon declined to comment. Under the current antenna service, AT&T pays the Central Authority $23,000 annually. The authority has paid Global Telecommunications $21,698 so far and will pay an additional $4,600 when contracts are finalized, according to John House, Centennial Authority CFO. This week's editor's notebook is from the editor, Sugata Merkehi. What can you do to fix the economy? Two things struck me as being very odd during what can easily be termed as the most tumultuous financial week in this country in the past 3 years. One was the performance of the S&P 500, the index comprising a cross-section of companies that have generated the lion's share of growth and profits over the past decade. And yet, if you invested $1,000 on the index 10 years ago, that would be valued below $1,000 today. Overall, the stock market over the past 10 years has increased a little over 35%. In contrast, if one invested $1,000 in the bond market 10 years ago, that investment skyrockets to $2,400 today. For decades, we've been hearing that if you are not going to touch your retirement money for a while, just use the index to invest and sit back. When it's time to cash in your investment, you will be pleasantly surprised what your money has done for you. And investing in the stock market is opening up a whole new set of questions for people who do not trade stocks daily or manage their portfolio through a financial professional. Are we searching for a whole new way to protect our money? To get an understanding of what's going on at the front lines of corporate America, I talked to two local CEOs in the past few days. Jim Whitehurst, CEO of Red Hat, a $1 billion technology company that also has $1 billion plus in cash in its coffers, and Lou Moshekos, CEO of LM Restaurants, a $57 million retail firm with scores of restaurants across the triangle. Like Red Hat, LM is a very profitable company. Whitehurst and Moshekos are in two completely different industries with unique sets of challenges, and yet their comments mirror each other's. We have government systems that cannot figure out how to pay for themselves in the U.S. or most of Europe, Whitehurst says. We do not have the political will to raise taxes or cut entitlements. And because of the inaction comes the downgrade of U.S. debt from Standard & Poor's, the somber rhetoric from the Federal Reserve that rates will stay low until 2013, and the extreme volatility in the stock market, making everyone nervous. For Moshekos, a self-made businessman from Greece, the country does not have very many options. Quote, I am willing to pay more taxes if my additional taxes are going to reduce the debt, Moshekos says, but we also need to pay attention to all these entitlement programs that are used by folks perfectly able to find work and contribute to society, end quote. Moshekos recalled meeting a friend just a few days ago who is collecting $800 a week in unemployment and will collect it for 72 weeks. He told me things are hard, and I told him things can't be that hard, Moshekos says. As Whitehurst points out, even 5 years ago, people thought about globalization as identifying a foreign country to do business in because labor is cheap. Not anymore. Quote, now you get this world order where there are non-Western companies with massive amounts of cash that may bring an imbalance to the fiscal and monetary flow, he says. Running a technology company, Whitehurst is in the know when he says technology and globalization are blowing up the country's middle class. Not only are jobs going abroad, companies are doing more with fewer people. Reflecting on the structural problems of this economy inevitably happens if stock markets go up 450 points one day and then fall 650 points the next. Lettice Whitehurst of Mosheko says, it's different this time. While action by four guys sitting in a room deciding to downgrade the U.S. debt did not help one bit, perhaps Washington will now realize that the country needs guidance and its citizens need a lesson in economics. We have to simplify our message so people can understand the fundamental shift in capital flow across the globe, the changing pattern of supply chain and demand for goods and services, and perhaps, most importantly, the need to sacrifice for the good of the country. I have no doubt in my mind that Mosheko's and Whitehurst, who collectively employ tens of thousands of people, will be the first in line if they are asked to sacrifice long term. Most other CEOs will join them as well. But just like they run their companies, they are asking for accountability and the need for everyone to pitch in. You can't have a segment of people pitching in and a segment of people sitting back and proclaiming, this is not my problem. It is a problem, and we are all responsible for it. It wasn't quite hitting the lottery, but an order received recently by a small apex pet accessory design firm called If It Barks was the business equivalent. My jaw dropped to the floor, says If It Barks owner Nicole Robbins. It's moments like these that make the hard work, sweat, and tears worthwhile. She was referencing word that folks at a pet specialty store in Finland called Musti Ja Miriti Ori recently got in touch with her regarding If It Barks, which offers a mod-style line of dog collars and leashes. The Finns want to partner up and represent If It Barks products in the Scandinavian nation. Robbins makes each product by hand and to order. She says she started the company after adopting two greyhounds 7 years ago. Turns out a product specialist at Mojasta Ja Mirioi has been ordering leashes from If It Barks for a while and liked them so much, she presented the products to her team in Finland. They loved them. And Robbins loves the new arrangement. One thing is for sure, she says, the love for one's dog is universal. Well said. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. To listen at the same time next week, be sure and mark us on your calendar. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is www.triangleReadingService.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.